This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm interviewing Steve Barry, the author of a book, a brand new book called The Paris Vendetta. How are you, Steve?
Fine, sir. Good to be here.
Well, thanks for talking to me. This is a new book in a series that you've done based on a character named Cotton Malone. How many books have you written in this series?
Well, this will be the fifth Cotton Malone adventure. He started in the Templar Legacy, where you met him, and then continued in the Alexandria Link, the Venetian Betrayal, the Charlemagne Pursuit, and now the Paris Vendetta. He's an interesting guy. He's a former Justice Department agent who now lives in Copenhagen and runs an old bookshop.
And I know that in the I won't give away too much of the story. I obviously want to make sure that readers coming to the Paris Vendetta will not have any of it ruined by knowing too much of the story. But at the beginning of that book, it starts with him being in his bookstore, and a kind of surprise series of events occur where there are some killers on the loose who are after a young guy who shows up unexpectedly in his store. Do you want to talk a little bit about the story, the kind of background? And
sure. Yeah, this is a series, but I write each book, by the way, where you can start in the middle and work your way back. So if you're just starting with the Paris Vendetta, nothing's going to be spoiled. They can go back and read the other four books. Certainly if you read them in order, there's a little more familiarity a little bit, but nothing overly so. This book is interesting because it's going to change up the series a little bit. There's some surprises in this book that those who have read the others will note. Those who are starting here will equally be surprised, but there's going to be some changes in Cotton Malone's world. Just like in real life, when things change in a fictional world as well. This book is a bit of a dark story. It deals with one of my characters, Henrik Tervallesen, and what happened to his son 2 years ago in Mexico City. And that's where Cotton and Henrik got to know one another after the tragedy of Henrik's son being gunned down. Cotton was there when Henrik's son was killed. And this story is going to resolve that conflict that Henrik has regarding the death of his son.
Now, that death plays a key role in this story. Obviously, it links the two characters as events unfold. But I noticed someone had written in onto your website about that particular event in Mexico that you just referred to. But that's not in any book at this point.
No, not to here. There's a beginning of the book where the very first opening chapters of The Paris Vendetta deal with that, and then there's a later chapter that deals with it too. So no, you're going to find out what happened exactly in Mexico City 2 years ago. If you're new to the series, though, it's not going to be anything you've missed. You're going to learn it at the same time everybody else learns it, and you'll figure out what's driving Cotton forward, what's driving Henrik forward. This book is also fascinating because I did something kind of interesting at the end of The Charlemagne Pursuit, which was last year's book. I ended it at the exact moment that this book begins.
That is interesting. Well, yeah. I am one of those people who have not read your work before, and I'm actually, I will say, I think this is, you're obviously a really good writer. This is well put together. The pace is great, and the writing is really strong, I think. But I certainly did not feel lost in any way. You're right that the book stands alone. You can pick this book up and read it. You don't have to know anything about your previous books.
Correct.
Clearly that may be beneficial for your regular readers. Have a richer understanding of this character, but he works fine in this book. And for me, this story, and I don't know about your other books, but this story is very very much kind of apropos of current events, and has a lot to do with international finance and the manipulation of money. I think it's safe to talk about that
a little bit.
I guess one question I had is, do you feel at yourself as you're exploring this idea that it, I mean, it feels pretty realistic. And, you know, as you're writing it, are you thinking about how this might be true?
I'll tell you an interesting story with this book. I wrote to the Paris Vendetta beginning in the latter part of 2007, finishing up around mid-2008. This was before the world financial collapse, before this whole problem came to bear of international markets being manipulated and things being done. So as I finished the book, all of that started coming in the papers, which was fascinating to me. I was going like, wow, this is pretty spooky. I just wrote about all this and kind of made a lot of this stuff up. And sure enough, a lot of the stuff that I was making up in the book actually towards the latter part of 2008 became real.
Well, I've always felt that writers, in the imagination, in the work of the imagination, you kind of are able to tap into I don't want to, go too far with this, but you're sort of tapping into a consciousness. Human beings, 6 billion people, there's a lot of consciousness floating around the universe. And it's possible that you kind of tapped into a kind of layer of awareness about what was going on.
It's interesting how you explain it. I can't really explain it myself. It was just a little bizarre how all that stuff that I was making up. I said, wow, some of this stuff actually did occur and happen. And as I said, it is very timely, dealing with economic manipulation, tied in with some ancient documents and some other things, and wrap around that Napoleon's lost treasure. So you put all that together, and that's where you get the Paris Vendetta.
Well, and I thought, actually, I do want to talk a little bit about Napoleon. There is, and you talked about this in the note in the book, certain elements of the story based on events that happened with Napoleon are true, and others you obviously made up, or at least imagined them, not knowing whether they're true or not. But I thought there were some really interesting quotations that the ringleader of your conspiracy is very interesting, I think, because she talks about elemental truth for her that seems to be very true, and that is the idea that if you can distract people as a country with war or the threat of terrorism, as she suggests, that you can cause people to willingly give up their rights in pursuit of safety.
Yes, and that's a concept that I came across in something called The Report from Iron Mountain. The Report from Iron Mountain was written back in the mid-60s. It was published as a book in the mid-60s. It was a very popular book. Supposedly, a group of intellectuals got together and came up with a way to govern and control society in peacetime. In other words, if you don't have war, how do you keep the people satisfied? How do you deal with collective aggression? How do you deal with governing people on a long-term basis, because war has been with us since time immemorial and has been used as a mechanism for political control. Now, it has now come to be recognized that the Report of Iron Mountain was a giant literary hoax, sort of a satire made up. But when you read the report, it is fascinating, and these concepts I took and used and incorporated them into the book. And those are what Eliza is working off of. Those are what Napoleon supposedly found in Egypt. I just sort of transposed that into an ancient document. But I thought it was really remarkable, of how the concept that war is good. War has positive things. War has a way of keeping society stable. It seems a little absurd until you sit down and think about it.
No, I understand. I actually thought that was a pretty important concept in the book that kind of helped me. It kind of kept me really involved because, of course, I may have a predilection for believing in conspiracy theories. Some people do and some people don't, but it kind of lends itself to it helps you understand how things work in a way.
Yeah, and war has also been a springboard for an enormous amount of technological advancement, scientific advancement, engineering advancement. It has done all of those things. Our best thinking is done in times of war, and this is what the report of Iron Mountain all talks about, to point out. As I said, they think, you know, the Guinness Book of World Records has now deemed that the greatest literary hoax of all time, but it's a fascinating read, whoever wrote it. There's a lot of concepts in there that make a lot of sense.
I remember reading about that book. I think it was, written by a group of people. And as you say, you know, satire often has great elements of truth in it. And fiction, as your book indicates, illustrates, fiction can have lots of true things to say about the way things work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's your imagination allows you to enter areas of truth.
It does, and fiction allows me to play with it just a little bit, too. That's why I could take the report from Iron Mountain written in the 60s and transpose it and make it a document from ancient Egypt.
Well, and I also was impressed with your portrayal of Napoleon and his kind of role in French history and the contradictions that you talked about. I was actually thinking about the fact that you said he loved his soldiers more than anything, but of course he was willing to sacrifice hundreds of thousands of them.
Yes.
In pursuit of his goals. So that, you know, the complexity, you illustrate well, I think, the complexity of life. It's not all black and white. It's life is complicated.
Yeah, but he was a great contradiction. I mean, he would talk about his soldiers and how he felt for them, but he was the first one to flee the battlefield. He was he had no problem sending millions of them to their deaths. It didn't bother him a bit. He was a fascinating guy, you know, and I didn't realize this till I wrote the book, that only Jesus Christ has had more books written about him. Napoleon is the second most written about character in all of history.
Well, that is amazing.
It's amazing. Yeah, this guy is fascinating. And when they captured him and they put him on Elba and he got off and he wreaked havoc again, you would have thought they would have killed him. They just kill him, get rid of him. But they don't. They send him down to St. Helena and put him in exile down there. And the British hold him for 5 years. And it's fascinating. Why keep this guy alive? Why not just get rid of him?
Well, they realized that if they did, he would have been a martyr for the French. I think they were afraid of what that would do.
There was some of that there. There was also another element there that they wanted to know what he knew, that Napoleon had a lot of knowledge in his brain. He was the greatest plunderer up to that time. Hitler may have surpassed him, but to that point in time, he was the greatest plunderer in all of history. He's the only one to plunder the Vatican. He stole on a grand scale, and very little of what he stole was ever recovered. And I read a lot about, historians believe, the British were looking for his lost cachet. They were looking for what he skimmed, what he kept. They were looking for that because war had been expensive. The Brits had been at war for nearly a century, almost constant warfare. And it had just taken an enormous toll on them. And some believe that they were waiting for him to make a mistake so they could find where he'd hidden away all that wealth.
And, of course, he never did, and they never found
him. No, never did.
And that, of course, gives you the basis for the novel. I mean, I don't want to give away too much, but the search for Napoleon's treasure,
yeah,
is one of the threads of your novel, which, you know, I think it's a complex novel. There's a lot of storylines going on, but that's clearly the underlying adventure for a number of people in the book.
It is, and that's what I always look for. I look for something lost from history that is ambiguous enough that I can take it wherever I need it to go.
Are you running out of lost mysteries?
They're getting harder to find. I won't disagree with you. I won't argue with you that they're harder to find. But luckily, I have enough for the next few years.
Well, that's good, because I can tell from the people who are the fans of your books really like these stories, and they probably are demanding that you write more.
They are, and there'll be at least two more Cotton Malone adventures in 2010 and 2011, and hopefully more after that. So I just finished the 2010 book, and I'm starting the 2011 book very shortly.
So do you have trouble at all kind of balancing? I would imagine writing this many books, you know, here you are, it's we're talking in November 2010. This Paris Vendetta comes out December 1st. So you're really now having to talk about a book that you wrote, as you said, you know, up to 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And then you've just written another one, and you have to imagine a third. You know, it's hard for me to understand how you can keep all of those balls in the air and keep them all straight.
Well, you have to keep, if you write a book a year, there's three in your brain at all times. Now, for me right now, there's actually four in my brain because I'm having to get Paris Vendetta back in my head so that I can talk about it over the coming months with the tour and the release. I've just finished 2010, but I'm doing all of the edits on that now. I'm beginning to write 2011, and I'm already plotting 2012.
Right. That seems very complicated to me. Yeah. I am a multitasking person. I work on a lot of different projects, but what it sounds like is that you've got to keep everything very organized in order to be able to do this.
You do have to keep it compartmentalized and think about it. But unfortunately, to do a book of year, that's just the way it works. Right now, until February, I'll have four, and then Paris Vendetta will leave my brain in February for good, and then it'll only be three in there.
And so do you feel like you can keep on doing this for, a number of more books, or are you going to sort of aim to close out the Cotton Malone series at a certain point?
No, I think we're going to keep him going. I really like Cotton Malone. I'm going to change up his world some. There are going to be, over the next 3 to 4 books, some changes in his world. You meet Sam Collins in this book, who's a new character we're introducing, and there's going to be other changes coming over the next 3 or 4 books. What I wanted is, I didn't want to get to a situation where you pick up a Steve Barry book and you say, well, you know, I know how this is going to end. I know everybody's going to be all right and everything's going to be fine. No, you're not going to know that with a Steve Barry book. You're going to pick it up and say, what is he going to do this time? You just don't know what'll change up. I'm gonna keep the reader a little off guard. I think that's good for me and good for them.
Well, I think you're right. Obviously, if you become too formulaic, after a while, it'll get boring for you, and that'll show in the work.
Yes, and I made a conscious effort in this book to shift. Next book shifts some more. The book after that shifts even a little bit more. Each one is going to have a little bit of change in Cotton's world.
Well, I'm very impressed with your writing. I think this is, you made a fan out of me. I do, before we end, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the foundation that you started called History Matters. Obviously, you have a strong interest in history. What is that all about?
Well, my wife Elizabeth and I have traveled around. We began to see that there's a huge problem with historic preservation all around America and all around the globe, actually. There's no money for historic preservation. It's the first thing that gets cut. We decided we'd like to try to do something to help out and give back, so we created History Matters, and we help local communities raise money for historic preservation projects. How we do it is a very unique way. We tap into sources that the historic preservation community would never be able to tap into. We just did an event in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. They needed some money, a few thousand dollars, for their oral history project at their local library that they're putting together, to buy some equipment and things to put that project together. So what I do is I go into town and I do a writer's seminar. That one I did for 3 hours, and a luncheon, and people paid $100 to come, and I taught writing for 3 hours. And then we had a lunch, and all of the money goes to the project. So we raised all of the money they needed for their oral history project in one morning to do, because we had enough people come to the seminar to do. The foundation pays for me to go. They do all of that. It doesn't cost anybody anything. So all of the money that's raised goes straight to the project. And we thought it would be a unique way to give back. We're helping writers, we're helping readers, and we're helping the community all at one time. And we thought it was a win-win. And we now have events scheduled in Virginia, South Carolina, California, Arizona over the coming months, and it's beginning to catch on. We just started this. So History Matters is pretty cool. And if anybody has a project in their area, they can go to my website, which is steveberry.org. There's a History Matters link there, and get in touch with us, and we'll see if we can come help you out.
Oh, I think that's a really good idea, and I agree with you. This is it's very important, and there is never enough money especially for local history and for kind of the ground up kind of stuff that I think you're talking about.
Yeah, it is.
The oral history, I think, is obviously I'm interested in oral presentation and oral history is, I think, something that almost anybody can participate in. It's very easy to do.
We can't raise you $100,000, but we can raise you $5,000 or $10,000 or $20,000. We can do that. And $5,000 goes a long way in historic preservation. You can do a lot with $5,000 that you didn't have before. So we feel like we've got a pretty good idea here. And plus, I've got a lot of stuff in me from 19 years of writing and 12 years of rejection, and I can pass that knowledge on to folks and try to help out writers.
Well, I think it's terrific that you're doing that, and I encourage readers to go, or listeners to of this podcast, to go to steveberry.org and click on the History Matters link, which is pretty, you know, evident down in the lower left-hand side of the homepage. Steve, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. I really enjoyed this. This is David Wilk for Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. Thank you, Steve Berry.
Thank you.